It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. How attached are you to your personal technology?
My laptop crashed and took a lot of my work with it.
Writer Alexander Weinstein.
I found myself crying over my laptop. And I noticed then just the bizarreness of crying over electronics. And this was about 8 years ago. A lot of students at that point, of my students, were getting iPhones. And they were all talking about, oh, I love my iPhone, right? And they kept using this word love. And that made me aware that we were starting to forge these emotional connections with our technology.
Actually, when you think about it, this seems kind of normal. I mean, there are days when I look at my phone more than I look at my family. It's kind of like my silicon best friend. Isn't that why we call it personal technology? Well, this hour, just how deep do those attachments go? We'll talk with filmmaker Astra Taylor and media theorist Doug Rushkoff. But first, Alexander Weinstein, author of Children of the New World, a debut collection of short stories about the dangers of our increasing reliance on digital technologies. Doug Gordon sat down with him to find out more.
Things have gotten more and more strange with Snapchat and Tinder and Grindr and all the different requests we have to join this or that social network.
Yeah. So let's talk about the very poignant and very powerful story, Saying Goodbye to Yang. Can you tell me a bit about this story?
Yeah. So here we have a world that's pretty close to our own. And the only real differences are that people are buying robotic big brothers and sisters as babysitters for their children. These can be of any nationality and sort of any background you want. And there's a little bit of tension between them and the cloning folk, right? There are people that are cloning themselves and cloning children. So there's a little bit of a kind of Whole Foods organic movement going on with the non-cloners, right? That's a sort of non-GMO. But they are erroneously, I think, leaning on technology as the place where they're going to find a way to stay human. And so they have this big brother who takes care of their adopted child, and his name is Yang. And at the opening of the story, he breaks down, he malfunctions. And so the drama of the story deals with trying to see if they can't reboot him or get him fixed, and realizing how much they've started to see him, this family has seen him as actually their son or as a child in their house. When we adopted Mika 3 years ago, it seemed like the progressive thing to do. We considered it our one small strike against cloning. Kyra and I are both white, middle class, and have lived an easy and privileged life. It was Kyra who suggested she be Chinese. The earthquake had left thousands of orphans in its wake, Mika among them. It was hard not to agree. My main concern were the cultural differences. The most I knew about China came from the photos and learned Chinese translations on the placemats at Golden Dragon. The adoption agency suggested purchasing Yang. He's a big brother, babysitter, and storehouse of cultural knowledge all in one, the woman explained. She handed us a colorful pamphlet. China, it announced in red dragon-shaped letters, and said we should consider. We considered. Kyra was putting in 40 hours a week at Crate and Barrel, and I was still managing double shifts at Whole Foods. It was true. We were going to need someone to take care of Mika, and there was no way we were going to use some clone from the neighborhood. Kyra and I weren't egocentric enough to consider ourselves worth replicating, nor did we want our neighbor's perfect kids making our daughter feel insecure. In addition, Yang came with a breadth of cultural knowledge that Kyra and I could never match. He was programmed with grades K through college and had an in-depth understanding of national Chinese holidays, like flag-raising ceremonies and ghost festivals. He knew about mooncakes and sky lanterns. For 200 more, we could upgrade to a model that would teach Mika Tai Chi and acupressure when she got older. I thought about it. I could learn Mandarin, I said, as we lay in bed that night. Come on, Kyra said. There's no way that's happening. So I squeezed her hand and said, okay, it'll be two kids then.
That was great, and that's one of the most powerful things about this story is that as you're reading it, you kind of forget that Yang is a robotic, that he's not a real child, and so as the story progresses, it's very poignant and almost makes you cry.
Yeah, it's very heartbreaking. I mean, I often say that I'm as duped as my characters because I feel for Yang too. I think he's a very sweet boy,
yeah,
and I do think Yang has a secret soul in there, but I don't know that that's true, right? I think it's just technology.
Yeah, exactly. It is just technology, and it's the human instinct to anthropomorphize animals and objects and things like that. With all the advances in robotics and AI, artificial intelligence, this story doesn't seem very far out of the realm of possibility, and that's one of the intriguing things about all 13 of these stories in your collection. It seems like you're performing this very tricky balancing act. If you make your predictions too specific, they can become obsolete very quickly. But if you make your predictions too abstract, they don't have the same impact because you're losing the power of the specific. How do you handle that?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, early on, so I have stories that became totally dated that aren't in this collection, right? One is early on when I was working with sort of apocalyptic visions, I had a story, I believe it was called How Your Mother and I Met, or How Your Father and I Met. And it had to do with this couple meeting online and exchanging, you know, links to music and links to videos. And how superficial would that be? And meanwhile, that's just like how we live now, right?
Yeah.
So that became just a realist story that really wasn't much of a critique at all. And that's always the case with a lot of these. I mean, I wrote these stories so they should be warnings. Let us not go down this path. Let us save our own humanity somehow from becoming addicted to technology. But a lot of the things are coming true, right? Apparently they're working on eye screens and contact lenses right now. And all of these things that for me were dystopian are happening. So it really, a lot of these stories become prophetic in that way, which is very discouraging to me rather than being, oh, great, I got it. And I think mostly what I was playing with and what inspired a lot of the plots of these stories is looking at what we're doing presently and then just moving it a step more absurd,
mm-hmm.
right? Going to the logical extension of what would be next and what would we find mildly horrifying right now. But once we got used to it, we would totally accept it because that's pretty much how we are with technology.
Yeah, very much so. And you mentioned that you do see these stories as warnings, so you do see them as cautionary tales.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I see it as that. You know, I think the hopefulness comes in the human interactions again and again, the way that the parents do love Yang. And I think when Yang breaks down, the narrator begins to realize the humanity of his family that he's missed and of his neighbors that he's judged and of all the people, the life going on around him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cautionary tale is really about how much are we disappearing into our technology right now? How addicted are we getting to that? And how much do we have the ability to step away from that and return to community building and things like that?
Another theme that recurs throughout these stories is the exploitation of spirituality for profit. For example, the story Moksha. What does the word Moksha mean?
Well, liberation. So moksha is a state of liberation where you transcend all, I suppose, earthly attachments to the ego, to material world, and are able to liberate oneself really from this world of desire.
Tell me a bit about, without of course giving away too many, if any, spoilers, what happens in the story Moksha?
Well, right. And so this is a Buddhist term. And the premise is that in this world, the U.S. government has cracked down on enlightenment, particularly because there's started to be these virtual enlightenment drugs that can get you to different states of Buddhist or Sufi liberation in some cases. And so you have drugs, we find out later, like trance, which is the Sufi one where you just want to spin and spin, or moksha that lets you transcend your ego completely and see the world as pure light.
Mm.
And the U.S. government has cracked down, and there's kind of these sort of meth lab equivalences where people are cannibalizing old Genesis and Nintendo systems and creating these almost tinfoil caps that you can wear.
Mm-hmm.
And there's these underground yoga studios where you can go and get these jolts of electronic enlightenment. But it's very sketchy and you can end up in jail. And there's all sorts of oxygen bar folks ending up in jail and what have you.
Yeah.
So our main character goes to Nepal,
where it said you can still get the real stuff, right? You can really get it there. Yeah. And if you go there, you can save up your money, you got to ask, but you'll find it. And so that's the premise of it, of this young kid named Abe. He's probably around, I think, 20 or so, and he's looking for enlightenment over in Nepal.
So now would be the ideal time to have you read an excerpt.
Great. So this is where Abe has finally found enlightenment. He's found the place in Nepal. It's set up as a blow dryer that he's about to have put on his head. Abe hesitated. Until now, he'd imagined he'd never find enlightenment. Faced with the beauty salon chair, he wasn't sure he was ready. What if, like Sandra's father, he became one of those modern-day sadhus who ate only raw food and talked about kombucha? He asked if he needed to do anything to prepare, meditate, breathe properly. No, just sit. We take care of moksha. Abe nodded and lowered himself into the chair. The kid dropped the blow dryer cap onto Abe's head, logged onto the laptop by the side of the chair, and hit enter. The jolt of moksha was immediate. One moment, Abe was sitting in the chair watching the men eat chicken curry and wondering what enlightenment would feel like. And the next second, their bodies transformed into bands of light. Where Abe had seen a dark, cluttered space, it became apparent that the configuration of computer boxes, the pile of plastic water bottles, and the mess of disemboweled laptops formed a sacred geometry whose mandala spread outward past the walls. Abe could see through the bricks to perceive the entire city. Every shop shone brightly with its display of 100 bronze Buddhas. And the taxis that cut their way through the crowds sent a chorus of honks into the air like birdsong. He saw the kids playing in the bricks, the white kid who had hugged him standing on the corner, haggling for a yak blanket, the words leaving the kid's mouth as illuminated air currents. He saw the light of their hearts beating beneath their skin while above and around and inside them was a force so bright that to look at it directly was blinding. He told himself to look away, but it was too late. His limited ego that tried to hang on was of minuscule value in comparison to the illumination of the infinite. Abe turned his inner eyes to the blazing light, and in that moment there was nothing left. No Abe, no Kathmandu, no Buddha. All names burned in the fire, leaving only a vibration that could best be described as love. Abe was certain he had died. But then he heard the kid's voice from far off. Okay, all done. He felt the dryer lift from his head and found himself back in the room. Oh my God, he uttered, and grasped the boy's arm. Yeah, okay, goodbye now. Next customer waiting.
I think that if there's one sentence that really sums up the major theme of your collection, it's one that comes from the title story, Children of the New World. The sentence is, "In this world, we seemed to understand. We were free to experience a physical connection that we'd always longed for in the real world, but had never been able to achieve." What do you think?
That's an interesting quote. Yeah. I mean, that's the lure, right, of the internet. In some ways, that's the sweet part, I guess you could say, of what the internet allows us, right? The beneficial sides is that we long for connection.
Yeah.
We long not to be lonely. We long to know that we're not crazy or that there are other people like us out there or that we're loved and these kind of very human emotions. And the internet promises, it still promises, that we will connect with other people. And it does. Obviously it does, right? People fall in love online and they meet long-lost friends and they come together. And I often think of somebody who is gay or bi in a small town and they don't know that anybody around them. They're surrounded by people that are telling them they're wrong and they can reach out to big cities and find out that they're not wrong, right, and that they have a community out there. These are examples of really great connection. The difficulty becomes that there's a way that we're also thwarted online. And so
I mentioned online dating, for example, where somebody can fall in love. But on the flip side, it also teaches you to, like, swipe people into the trash that you don't like. Mm-hmm. And so there's this great loneliness or this great kind of cold-heartedness that it can create, wherein I think we start to see people as commodities. There's also this hope to become a YouTube sensation. And so there's a survival of the fittest capitalism that has snuck in to all our online interactions, so that if I write, you know, something about, I don't know, Paris in an email, suddenly I'll see in my banner trips to Paris,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And that becomes very sketchy and very more of this feeling of constantly being used. And I think a sort of materialist philosophy ends up intruding into our online interactions that can cause much more loneliness than the internet originally promised us.
Alexander Weinstein. He's the author of the debut short story collection, Children of the New World. Doug Gordon talked with him. And let's hear Weinstein read one more bit, this time from the title story, in which spam and malware take the form of humans terrorizing a young couple in their home.
The frequently asked questions didn't cover this. And it was only after searching through other users' blog entries that we figured out how to delete him from our home. But during our next session, when the doorbell rang, we opened the front door and encountered a man from Ghana who told us he was a distant relative. He'd brought our children presents, he said. He needed our credit number to upload the toys for the kids. We locked the door, but we could see the man outside, pacing first on our porch and then climbing into our bushes to knock on our windows. We deleted the African man, but when night came, our lamps no longer lit our home with soft warmth, but contained a shadowy light, and our house was filled with the feeling of being watched by countless eyes, our every action scanned for information. I logged off to call online support. The man on the other end of the line spoke broken English, the line buzzing from an overseas connection. He tried a couple options with me and finally said, "Sir, your account is corrupted. You'll have to reset all files to the initial settings." "What's that mean?" "You must delete all data from your account, your preferences, photos, music. You'll need to recreate your bodies again." "I see you have children." "Yes." "You will need to delete them."
"What?"
"The virus has spread to them. You'll have to delete them and begin again." "I'm sorry, sir." "I'm not deleting my children." "Yes, sir. I understand. It's your choice. But the system has a fatal error. It'll only get worse. Your account is filled with viruses. You will not want your children in that house soon. Put your supervisor on." "Yes, sir." Then I was put on hold for 10 minutes of light jazz until a supervisor and later her supervisor told me the same information, that we should have installed an antivirus protection plan. Without it, there was little left to do but return our system to factory settings. "What if we move to a new house?" "I'm afraid all your family's corrupted," the supervisor told me. "You'll just end up bringing the virus with you. It's an easy process to reboot. Simply hold down the power button on your console for 20 seconds and..." "These are my children," I yelled. "It's any consolation, they won't feel a thing. They're just data."
Alexander Weinstein. From his short story collection, Children of the New World. Coming up, filmmaker Esther Taylor tells us why we need to take back the internet, and Chuck Klosterman says social media ruins everything, including death. I'm Ann Strandchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. Thank you. The internet changes everything, including death. Just ask Chuck Klosterman.
I think the internet did it. I think the internet changed my perception of death. I was going to the new Richard Linklater movie, Everybody Wants Some, and I look on my phone and Prince has died. And I was a big Prince fan, and, you know, for lots of reasons. Musical, but also because I'm from North Dakota and he was from Minneapolis. There was this weird connection, sort of, I guess, being in Wisconsin, same thing. But also it's like a certain kind of, like, northern Midwest. Like, I feel like our Midwest is very different than what most of America thinks of the Midwest as Iowa and Kansas and stuff. And this feels different, you know, more isolated. So I was like, boy, this is a real bummer or whatever. So I turn off my phone and I watch the movie, and I watch the whole thing kind of vaguely thinking about Prince. Not directly, I mean, I followed the plot, but it was always sort of there. But then I walk out of the movie and I turn my phone back on and I start looking at social media, and suddenly it feels like I didn't care about Prince at all. Like these people are acting as though that their whole life is shutting down. Like, I was able to go to a movie, you know, I got popcorn. Then I was like, well, this is weird. Like, am I an unfeeling person? Or is something going on with death now that isn't like these people talking about, you know, remembering hearing Purple Rain at like their eighth grade dance or whatever? Like, they're only kind of talking about Prince. It was almost as though they were waiting for Prince to die. They didn't realize this, but they were waiting for Prince to die so they could connect themselves and their life to this thing other people sort of had a connection with. And that's not terrible. I mean, like, I feel like kind of a jerk saying, like, oh, how dare these people be upset by you? It's like, on balance, maybe it's good, but something can be good and still be weird.
Commentary from Chuck Klosterman. His latest book is called 10. There's a reason we just can't get enough of the internet. In her new book, The People's Platform, filmmaker Astra Taylor argues that our digital life is undemocratic because we've handed our political and economic power over to giant tech corporations who are making money off every post and tweet we make.
I think we need to talk about the way that these devices and these platforms and these websites are actually addictive by design. Every aspect of a website like Facebook is tested to see what gets us to engage the most. So everything from the color schemes to where buttons are placed, and they need to maximize our engagement, to maximize our clicks, because they get data from that. And that's actually the business model of these sites. They're advertising financed. And so they need us to engage and to give more information and to like as many things as possible, because that's where the profit comes from. So I think it's important to shift that, to go, this is not just about us being unable to control our impulses. It's more like the way sugary cereals are stocked on the bottom row at the grocery store so that, you know, kids go crazy and can't help but ask their parents for them.
Well, this sounds like media criticism 101, in the sense that, remember the discussions of subliminal advertising back in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, you know, there is something surprisingly retrograde. I've been saying that we've almost arrived in a retrograde future, because there was this idea that the internet would break us out of all of these old systems and out of the old media model, you know, out of the old broadcasting model where a small number of people got to tell us what to watch because they programmed the television or the radio. But I that's why I find it so interesting that for all of this technological innovation, we're still actually completely advertiser dependent. I mean, with the exception of Wikipedia, we do not spend any time on non-commercial spaces on the web. Hmm. No, you know, there's no significant non-commercial website online. So we're in this strange moment where you see a resurgence of things like native advertising, which is essentially brand sponsored content or news, you know. This conjures up the old days of soap operas that sold soap, or the Camel News Caravan, which was a cigarette sponsored news show. So again, the retrograde future, we've kind of come forward technologically, but economically we're still in the old days.
Well, that kind of sheds new light on why everybody likes Mad Men so much.
Yeah, I mean, because it's still relevant. That's still, in many ways, the system that we're in. And, you know, the advertising industry is has not been disrupted, to use the kind of Silicon Valley jargon, at all. There's more and more money going into that arena, and more of it's flowing online in ways that I think are pretty troubling if you care about democracy. And that really is media criticism 101. And I think there was this idea that the internet almost made that kind of media criticism irrelevant, because, again, we would all be able to choose and be in charge of ourselves in this digital sphere. And I think what we need to actually think about how that school of thought applies in a digital age.
I guess in some ways, maybe we sort of feel like the ads are just the price we have to pay for getting this huge thing called the internet. I mean, for example, yeah, I liked Facebook a lot better before all the ads, but, you know, mostly I see them as an annoyance and I scroll past and I just don't look at them. And I do get to connect with my friends for free. Maybe the ads are just the price I have to pay.
Right. I think there needs to be a more critical interrogation of the idea that we get these services for free, because, you know, advertising isn't free. We are paying with our data, which is what these marketers then collect and analyze and use to reach us with their targeted pitches. And I think there are actually social costs that go far beyond just the kind of annoyance element of, you know, sort of these things in the side of my browser that I don't want to look at. And those elements are really important, because the way that advertising used to work, it was much more straightforward, right? Something would come on the TV or the radio that interrupted the regularly scheduled programming and you could turn it off. But what happens is you can never turn off these systems of tracking online. I mean, and this leads not just to, again, the annoying ads, but to things like price discrimination, because what one person sees on the web isn't what another person sees online. So I might get an ad that says, you know, Astra Taylor, enroll at this fancy college next year. But somebody else might get an ad that says, hey, enroll at this predatory for-profit college. You know, there's real concerns about redlining, about people being offered different interest rates or different prices on goods that will kind of reinforce old social inequities. So again, it's not as simple as just seeing ads. There's also this question of like, well, what kind of culture do advertisers want to support? Because you might say, okay, it seems like a fair trade-off now. I liked Facebook better before. But the question is, what direction is it heading in? And so we're seeing signs of that with things like the pay to promote. You know, it's getting harder and harder for groups to reach their bases, the people that they've managed to connect with. You know, a community group might have 10,000 likes or something like that, but now it's only reaching a fraction of them when it sends out a message.
And on the other hand, it's interesting that, you know, a lot of us regard the internet and digital technology as this great democratizing force, you know, that gives everybody a platform to be heard regardless of status. I mean, think about the Arab Spring.
That was something that really motivated me to take a more critical look, because I've got various sort of sidelines. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I work as a journalist, but I also do a lot of organizing and activism. And so this issue of democracy really matters to me, and people having a voice. And I was concerned about the fact that we are handing over so much power to these corporate platforms, because the internet, again, because there are very few non-commercial spaces online, we confuse ourselves when we talk about it as a sort of public square. You know, when I go out and I protest in the streets, I have certain rights, rights that cannot be impinged upon by the government. I have the right to assembly and free speech and stuff like that. And when you go onto these social media sites, you are agreeing to a terms of service and you're handing away a lot of those rights. So if those are kind of our agoras in the digital age, you know, there are real concerns in terms of maintaining our freedom to protest and our freedom to challenge people in power.
Sure, but can't you do the same thing online? You can create a blog and put it up there, make a video and put it on YouTube.
Yeah, the thing is that you can, but those sites ultimately can take anything you put up there down. And there have been some examples of Middle East protesters putting up pictures of the documented violence onto a site like Flickr, wanting to spread the word and say, this is happening to us. And then Flickr took all of the photos down and said, well, you know, we don't allow pictures of violence on our site. And they were saying, well, these are political photographs documenting something really important. So it's just that sense that these spaces are not safe. We can't count on them in the same way because, again, they're private. I mean, I can't go and lead a protest in a shopping mall, right? Because that's not public space. That's private property. And these platforms are more like private property. They're more like shopping malls than they are like the things we like to compare them to. We like to say Google's a library, or we like to say Twitter's a town square. But there are major differences there. I feel like our analogies kind of confuse us. I feel like the question to me at a philosophical level is like, well, what would a real public square look like in the digital world? Like, we don't have any real examples of that. And I think it would be kind of neat to get together and try to make those.
It's really interesting hearing you say that because, you know, these same critiques were made of commercial television back in the dark ages. And it's kind of funny to think it was only, what, a few decades ago that NPR was created. Are you saying we need a public digital sphere? And then what would that look like?
Right. I think we do need that. It's really interesting to go back to the history books and read about the evolution of public or non-commercial media in the United States. And we were pretty late on the bandwagon, right? Mm-hmm. Something like public broadcasting only emerged in the 60s. But people were sounding the alarm about it and trying to build alternatives going way back to the early days. So I feel like we could hypothetically be heading towards that kind of tipping point in the digital space where you just go, I'm tired of all my news being actually like branded content.
So you're really talking about maybe we're heading toward a new era of regulation on the internet and simply applying some of the same kinds of regulations the FCC applied to radio and television stations maybe need to be kind of readapted for the digital age. So that's kind of at this larger political level. What about, are there things that individual users could do?
Yeah, there's, you know, we have to not be as susceptible to convenience as the ultimate virtue. And it's very hard as an internet user. I think that if we could resist convenience, the temptation of convenience, and do things that are a bit more difficult in the digital space, that could have a big impact. So what do I mean? I mean things as simple as not always buying everything from Amazon. Right, you can buy books from your local bookstore, even if you're not physically near them, by going to that store's website. Since writing my book, I've started to use non-Google email services. There are things like RiseUp.net, which is a nonprofit, privacy-respecting email service, or Fastmail, where you pay, you know, a small sum in the scheme of things for email, but in return, you're not paying with your personal data and you're not being subjected to advertising. So I think there are lots of little things that we can do. But in the book, I try to balance these individual options with an awareness that we do need to think about bigger collective political fixes and that we shouldn't be so afraid of the word regulation. I mean, you know, doing nothing means that we are basically giving more and more power to the marketing, advertising and marketing industry and to this handful of big corporate players.
Astra Taylor is a filmmaker and author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. There's a scenario that used to be a staple in comedy or humor. The whole family on the couch, each person absorbed in a different mobile device. It used to be a joke. Now it's just real. For three decades, MIT professor Sherry Turkle has been studying the ways we interact with machines through her books The Second Self and Life on the Screen. And in her most recent book, Alone Together, she explores the toll digital technology is taking on our personal relationships.
We are living a life mix of what's in the physical and what's in the virtual. And I think that's genuinely new. And that can only come if you have a device with you that lets you, you know, literally be at dinner with your friends, looking up and looking down then a moment at your BlackBerry and doing something in your virtual world, doing something on Facebook, that your life is a mixture of what you do in the real and in the virtual. I was at a funeral. People at the funeral party are hiding their BlackBerries under the funeral program. They're texting. And it didn't just happen once. It happened several times, and many people have spoken to me about similar experiences they've had. It's about not taking a moment at the times that we need to be most present to each other. It's not just about letting our attention wander. It's about forgetting the point of the exercise, which is to be with each other at the times that count. To take a time that's less dark, I was speaking to someone who was talking about a 15-year-old birthday party. And There's a point at this party when everybody wants to go home. And part of being 15 and successfully getting to be 16 is that 15-year-olds have to fight through that moment and learn to get along with each other and to make it work with each other. But at this 15-year-old birthday party, everybody could just, you know, get on their Facebook and be elsewhere and not have to deal with each other. And this option to not just ignore each other, but to really find an active social place in the world that doesn't include each other, I think that is genuinely new. We really need to think about when we need to deliberate, when we need to just be with each other. I think the question is not turning off our technology, not giving it away. This is wonderful technology, but it needs to be put in its place. And sometimes we really just need to be with each other and give each other our full attention. And that's the sense that I fear that we're losing and we need to refocus on.
MIT social scientist Sherry Turkle. She's the author of Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. Coming up, media theorist Doug Rushkoff says technology is changing the way we think about time. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. I don't know about you, but I feel like I can never, ever, no matter what I do, keep up with the endless torrent of email and Facebook, not to mention Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and all the rest. Well, media theorist Doug Rushkoff says all this technology is actually changing our relationship to time, and we're all having trouble adapting to it. He talked with Steve Paulson.
Doug, the title of your book, Present Shock, is a reference to Alvin Toffler's 1970 book, Future Shock. What's the difference between future shock and present shock?
Well, I guess in some sense, maybe the sensation might be similar. The real difference is that the future that Alvin Toffler was describing that we were moving towards is here with us now. So while Toffler was really warning us really to learn how to orient to a world that was changing ever more rapidly, to basically be able to adjust to change itself. I'm arguing that that change has happened, that if anything, you know, as we passed from the 90s into the 21st century, we became less of a society that was just obsessed with the future and what's next and what's happening, what's the next big thing, where is it all going? And we became a society that was very much in the moment, in a kind of an always-on, real-time, hyper-connected moment. So our focus really becomes less about how do we adjust to change to something much more like how do we adjust to living in a world where everything is happening seemingly at the same time.
Well, you break this idea of presentism down into five big areas, and let's talk about those. One you call digiphrenia. What is this?
Well, digiphrenia is interesting, and it kind of comes out of that video game sensibility. I mean, the beauty of video games is that instead of watching some other character go through a story, you're the one going through the story. You know, you're the one making the choices in real time, and you move from choice to choice to choice to choice rather than watching these canned choices. It's the sense of agency. But, you know, the digital environment very often makes it seem like you don't even have to choose. You don't have to choose between this and that. You can choose both. And we're doing so many things online where we're choosing both that we've ended up with really multiple instances, multiple incarnations of ourselves, kind of running simultaneously on all these different platforms. And it's very hard to live with more than one you. You know, digital technology is great for copying things, but human beings don't copy so well. So there's you on Twitter that maybe somebody's commenting on something that you did. There's you in your inbox that's filling up with messages that are waiting for responses. There's you on Facebook who might be being used to advertise a product you never even heard of while you're asleep, you know, and you'll wake up that you've been in these sponsored stories. You know, so how do you deal with all of these different yous running simultaneously? That's sort of the essence of this digiphrenia or this kind of digital confusion.
So you're basically saying that it's enough to make you a little crazy. There's almost like a split personality here because we're tending to so many different digital personae.
Right. And even if your personality is not split, your digital personalities are split and your single personality is going to have to deal with all of them. I got the idea for the digiphrenia chapter when I was in the lobby of a hotel in Berlin. I kept trying to log into my Google Calendar to see if I could do one talk at the same time as another talk, whether I'd be able to get from one to the other in time. And each place I went, I couldn't log in until I finally got Wi-Fi and I'm in this lobby. And I get this message back from Google that they locked me out of my calendar because they said I was trying to log in from too many places at once, right? So Google Calendar didn't believe I was a human being. They didn't believe one human could be in all those places at once. And that, to me, seemed to be the essence of, you know, the problem we have with digital culture. It's not this idea of information overload, and all these people have all these problems with digital technology. And this, I promise you, Present Shock is not one of these books. It's just whining and hand-wringing about the problems of digitality. But what I do get concerned about is our readiness to really to put our human lives into digital timeframes. You know, digital technologies really don't understand time. They live outside time. They're just sequences. You know, your Twitter feed is not in real time. It's just trying to catch up with you. Just because people are sending emails out to you, it doesn't mean that now you have to respond in real time to them, right? The beauty of digital technology was that it waited. You know, the early conversations we used to have on the bulletin boards, we were all so smart because we had all the time in the world to respond to these things. We sounded smarter online than we did in real life.
Right. Well, and the irony, of course, is that this was supposed to make our life better. It was supposed to make it easier, and it seems like it's just made us feel crazier.
Right. And that's because, and I mean, and not to get leftist on you or anything, but I really do believe it's because instead of using digital technology kind of for slack, which is what we saw it as, right? We're all going to be able to work from home in our underwear anytime we want, you know, because we'll just get our work done and turn it in as it's ready, rather than going to work for this 8 hours a day and being always on while you're there. What we ended up doing instead was kind of taking the time is money efficiency values of the industrial age and translating them onto the digital age, where digital technology really, if we're going to embrace it the way I think we can, it's about really liberating ourselves from these obsolete industrial age priorities and embracing a totally different really way of working in a much more peer-to-peer fashion where we create value and sell it directly to one another rather than going in and having these sort of 9-to-5 jobs that are really just a relic of the first factories of the 1300s.
Now, another aspect of this presentism that we've been talking about is what you call overwinding. What do you mean by overwinding?
Yeah, it's funny. I got the idea for overwinding when I was rereading Stuart Brand's great book, The Clock of the Long Now, in order to write this one. What he argues in there is that we need to think in these great sort of 10,000-year time spans.
And this is sort of following up on an actual clock that is being built that will last 10,000 years.
Right. I'll be interested to see if they actually finish the actual clock. I guess there's enough money that went into it. You know, to me, it was just as valuable as a thought experiment, really. What would it be like to build this thing? What would it mean? The most important thing is that now people, he wants us to think in these 10,000-year spans rather than just, you know, next year or even next century. what is the impact of this over 10,000 years? And I was trying to do that, you know, and I had this plastic water bottle. I was about to get on a plane. I didn't see a recycle bin. There was just a trash can there. And I'm like, do I just throw it out? You know, is it going to be 10,000 years? And I realized it wasn't feeling like a long now to me. It was feeling more like a short forever. And that's where I got the idea of overwinding, where in a presentist society and an always-on sort of micro-moment managed society, it's very tempting to try to compress these really long timescales into really short periods of time. So you'll see examples of that, say, you know, on the stock market, where people don't buy in order to invest in the future of a company, they buy in order to make money on the trade, right? So people buy Facebook in the morning and they're mad 5 minutes later that it hasn't gone up and they go sell it. And people who aren't satisfied with that, you know, they end up buying derivatives on stocks, which are really just a way to buy the future stock now, or you buy a derivative on the derivative.
So are there solutions here? I mean, one of the things that you talk about is what you call spring loading. What's that?
Well, spring loading would be a positive way of looking at winding, saying, okay, we can do time compression, but let's do it consciously and willfully rather than just as a way of trying to beat the clock. Or let's at least apply it to areas where timing is necessary. So there's a hospital, you know, it's a hospital in Israel. They wanted to be able to sort of have a hospital in a box that you could just pop on a soccer field somewhere and it would just kind of expand. So what they do is they take a whole lot of time and they put into preparation, you know, okay, what if we're going to have an OBGYN clinic and we're going to have a disease thing and a virus control and something for refugees and starvation? You know, they work out the whole thing and they actually do pop it into these crates and stick it on a cargo plane and they sit and wait. And when the Haiti earthquake happened and when the Japanese tsunami happened, Israel sent over this plane. They popped this thing out on parachutes and the doctors and nurses land on a different plane. And in hours, they have a giant working hospital. You know, the hospital they put in Haiti was better than any local Haiti hospital. And they just dealt with such high volumes of people. And that's really just this sort of a positive way of looking at time, how you can compress something and then explode it out.
Well, it raises questions, fascinating questions about what we mean by real time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a traditional sense of real time of, you know, it was kind of what we would do with our physical body, you know, not dealing with any kind of digital technologies. And yet real time has taken on an entirely different meaning now.
Oh, it has. Real time means this sort of always on Twitter feed. Oh, that's real time. And of course, that's not real time. That's 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, 10 seconds ago. It's still not you in real time. The Greeks actually understood this way back when, even with the sundial or whatever they had two different words for time. You know, there's the typical one, chronos, which means time of the clock, like it's 4:01. And they had this other word, kairos, which meant timing. And timing was more about your readiness or the appropriateness. Timing was what only humans could really understand. It's like, you know, I crashed the car at 4:01, but what's the best time to tell Dad that I crashed the car? You know, is that 5:01? No, it's timing. You know, that's after he's had his drink and before he's opened the bills, right? It's much more subtle. And that more and more time you spend aware of timing and being ready, the more you begin to connect with all of these cycles that, you know, you could call them new age, but they're actually real. I mean, when you ask me how I work according to the moon. You know, I became aware of Irving Dardik, this Olympic trainer who was getting all these great results by sort of matching people's workout routines to lunar cycles and looking at different weeks of different tides, and it also affects your body's chemistry differently.
Wait, so how do you do this? You work according to the lunar cycle?
Yeah, believe it or not, because what new research is showing, I mean, you can see it in the book or there's a bunch of places like somaspace.org is a great place to look at this stuff or go to Irving Dardik's Superwave site. So this is edge science, if you will. So it's the kind of thing that, you know, you do a little experimentation on yourself and just see what works and what doesn't. What I found out from them was that over a 28-day lunar cycle, there's sort of four main weeks. 28 days is 4 7-day weeks. And in each week, a different neurotransmitter seems to dominate our brain chemistry. The first week is acetylcholine, the second week is serotonin, third week is dopamine, and the last week is norepinephrine. So if you know that, you go, oh my gosh, it's not just me, but everybody's on acetylcholine this week. That means they're going to have good energy, right? They're going to be peppy. It's going to be great for introducing them to new ideas. Serotonin week, everybody's going to have a lot of energy to work. You know, everybody's going to be very productive. So that's when I do my writing. I don't even worry about it the next week. Dopamine week, you're not going to get anything done dopamine week. That's when you're going to go skiing and party and go nuts, right? And the final week, norepinephrine, that's the fight or flight neurotransmitter. So that's putting everybody in a very sort of analytic, structural, sort of Barack Obama mindset. You know, that's where to organize my calendar. That's when to organize the chapters of my book. So when I did that, I stopped thinking of dopamine week, which did turn out to come up every month, as writer's block. That's not what it is. It's something else. This is the time when I'm going to enjoy people and have my parties and do my crazy stuff. You know, and then when I looked at it that way, you know, and I just did it by my efficiency in terms of words, my word count went up about 40%.
Really?
Yeah, when I worked really according to these sort of underlying biological clocks. And this stuff, which we look at as folklore now, you got to remember, we looked at jet lag as folklore and old wives' tales until it was Major League Baseball managers started to realize their pitchers did way better when they traveled from the East Coast to the West than when they traveled from the West Coast to the East. And it didn't make sense until they really came to understand how biological clocks work, our relationship to our melatonin in the sun. And there's all of these other cycles. That's what keeps people alive and in time. You know, and when we ride roughshod over it, either with, you know, shift work, trying to be always on, trying to have the same responses in the second week of a cycle as the third or the fourth, that we're always the same. I mean, you can push over it if you're a professional. You can do your show every day. But if you become aware of it, you can realize, oh, my shows this week are going to be more like this, and my shows that week are going to be more like that. You can really schedule, you know, your sort of intellectually challenging ones.
You're giving me whole new ideas on how to produce radio here.
It's true. And then put the music stars and those folks on dopamine week, you know, and you can play a tune and do all that. It really does work.
Doug Rushkoff is the author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. I talked with Steve Paulson. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced this hour, with help from Charles Monroe Kane and Mark Rickers. Thanks to Steve Gotcher for engineering. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.